Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning. It's January 21st. And let's see, currently in Old Town Park City, we're reporting 5 degrees. Heber City at 0 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Wasatch back. Yeah, what a brutal start to your Tuesday morning with these frigid temperatures in place. Add a little bit of a light breeze. Wind chill values have been coming in sub-zero across much of our mountain areas or mountain valleys. Highs today stay below freezing, about 30 degrees in Park City, 32 in Heber. Temperatures again tonight, maybe not quite as frigid cold. We're 9 degrees forecast for Park City and for Heber tonight. 27 tomorrow for Park City. A weak storm system brushing by northern Utah will generate a little bit of colder air in place. So 27 tomorrow, 29 returning on Thursday. Friday we rebound as southwest flow picks up ahead of a weekend storm system. So pretty quiet weather, just cold through middle of the week. But on Friday we will see increasing cloud cover throughout the day. Snow showers pushing in over the weekend. So a cold front sweeps in. We'll drop from 37 to 27 Friday into Saturday. Plan on snow showers. Right now early estimates show several inches of snow for Park City, hopefully 2 to 4 is what the current forecast is calling for. 7 degrees as we get into Sunday morning with 23 for the high. Some lingering snow showers expected Sunday, and then we'll start to clear out Monday. Staying cold though, 4 degrees on Monday morning with 27 for the high. So similar conditions for Heber, of course. Overnight low single digits still, as we mentioned, into tomorrow. As we get into Thursday morning, about 1 degree. 32 for the high on Thursday with sunshine. 12 degrees into Friday with 40 for the high. So south flow really helping bump up our temperatures temporarily, but then dropping back to freezing on Saturday. So plan on snow showers. Single digits again into Sunday morning with 26 for the high on Sunday afternoon. Some lingering snow showers expected on Sunday, and then we should clear out but have partly cloudy skies on Monday. Highs will stay below freezing at just 30 degrees.
Okay, it's hard. Cold,
it's hard
but
with
no
the cold.
Snow.
Stay warm.
Okay, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:08.
This KPCW weather report is brought to you in part by Deer Valley Resort, deervalley.com.
And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, we've got Dave. Good morning.
They were looking at an overall moderate avalanche danger for wind-drifted snow avalanches in mid and upper elevation terrain. Yesterday, we didn't have any reports from backcountry users either in the Salt Lake, Ogden, or Provo area regions. And we are also continuing to hold on to the advice that people may have a slight possibility of triggering an avalanche failing down to that buried, persistent weak layer of dry facets near the ground. But really, for today, the primary concern is going to be the wind-drifted snow near ridgelines.
Okay, Dave, thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybell. He'll preview this week's county council meeting. Later on, our first legislative report with KUR reporter Sean Higgins and former Recycle Utah Executive Director Carolyn Warr, joined by Interim Director and Board Member Jim Bedell, discuss what's next in finding a new Executive Director. Well, in the wake of the Park City Mountain Ski Patrol strike, communications experts are discussing how Vail Resorts publicly handled the situation. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports one professor says it was an example of what not to do.
Dartmouth Tuck School of Business professor Paul Argenti wrote the textbook on corporate communication and now regularly consults with Fortune 500 companies. Argenti said on KPCW's Mountain Money, Park City Mountain failed when it came to communications with guests during the strike.
I think they did a pretty bad job, to be honest with you. I mean, for one thing, you know this is coming. It is what I would describe as kind of a predictable surprise for a company. And given that that's the case, you know, your communications should be much more transparent and honest, and, you know, you need to have open communication channels. And instead, from what I could see, there isn't a whole lot of communication out there.
Park City Mountain owner Vail Resorts is now facing a class action lawsuit as a result of the strike. The lawsuit claims that less than 20% of the mountain was open during the 13-day strike, which left guests who spent thousands on Christmas ski vacations in long lift lines waiting for up to 3 hours at times. Park City Mountain Chief Operating Officer Deidre Walsh previously apologized to pass holders about the impacts and said resort management tried to avoid a strike. Walsh said union members hurt their fellow employees, skiers and snowboarders, and neighbors by choosing to strike during the peak holiday period. Walsh also said Park City Mountain opened the terrain it could each day during the strike based on the staffing available. Argenti said the resort's public messaging should have prioritized informing guests about the on-mountain impacts of the strike.
You want to maintain, you know, make sure that people understand that you really have a commitment to kind of get this resolved. They obviously don't have a good public relations or communications team, either in-house or that they hire in, to explain the company's perspective without vilifying workers or the union. I mean, they must be just completely winging it. And if they do have a communications person or an outside agency, they did a terrible job and should be fired.
Poor guest experiences at Park City Mountain garnered national headlines, with some vowing to never purchase an Epic Pass again. Argenti said consumers typically have short-term memories, but that Vail should still be proactive in repairing its reputation.
I do think it will have an effect on long-term relationships, and they need to fix that before it gets to that point. They really need to do something before they get there. And they have to have a different approach to communications overall going forward. If they can do that, it can get beyond this pretty quickly. If they don't, more things like this will continue to happen.
In a statement last week, Vail Resort CEO Kirsten Lynch said the company deeply regrets the disruption caused by the strike. Lynch said Vail is committed to rebuilding guest loyalty and trust. To make up for the impacts over the holidays, Park City Mountain is offering discounts on passes next season to skiers and riders on the mountain during the strike. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock. And on the phone with a preview of the meeting, I have County Manager Dustin Graham. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, first up is a discussion of Gavin Peterson. Who's he?
He is a wheelchair athlete that Wasatch County helped support last year, and he's coming back to report on his event.
Okay, so what kind of athlete?
A wheelchair athlete.
Oh, wheelchair, okay. And can you give us a preview of his accomplishments?
You know, I honestly don't know. I was asked by Parks and Rec to help facilitate the meeting, and I think I know that he's been a high-performing athlete here locally, and he was headed off to some more regional competitions, I believe.
Okay, and so the county supported him financially, and he's coming back to tell you what a good job he did.
Yes.
Okay. Later on, a discussion and consideration of a Heber City initiative to recognize the Wasatch County Daughters of the Utah Pioneers Museum. What's the initiative?
So Heber City has a leadership academy that they use to help invest in community members and train staff and others. And every year they do a project. This year the project is that they are putting up plaques around historic buildings in Heber City. And the DUP Museum, which is the old Wasatch County Library, is one of the facilities that they want to do it. The county council has expressed their support, and they're curious to hear a little bit more about what they want to do and the specifics of what they want to put on that sign.
Okay, so is the county paying for the signs?
No, I believe that they raise their own money and are installing them in the public right-of-way adjacent to the building.
Okay. Let's see. Wasatch County will also be giving $2,000 to the Wasatch County High School Conservation Team. What for?
So every year, Wasatch County has the best soil conservation team in the state. I don't know exactly how many years it's been running, but we consistently win state and then send a team out to a national commission. I believe this year it's in Oklahoma. So we've supported them in the past, and this year we're planning on continuing that support to help them go compete on a national level.
So what does a soil conservation team do?
So they've explained it for a few years now that basically they are assigned a field and a competition, and they have to evaluate elements of that field for its use in agriculture, like the makeup of the soil, the slope of it, and what types of crops would be suitable to be raised there. I think it's something that really matches the values of our rural character here in Wasatch County, and something that the council is very happy to support.
All right. Later on, a discussion and consideration of a resolution adopting a Memorial Hill policy. What does this do?
What we're trying to do is make sure that everybody knows about Memorial Hill and what the criteria is to get on there. We've not ever adopted a formal written policy on it, but basically what this would do is outline that any member of the armed services that has served may be eligible to have their name placed on Memorial Hill. This is subject to if they have lived in the county for long enough, or if they've received a Purple Heart, or if they were deployed from Wasatch County.
Okay, so how would people attempt to get their names on that?
So that's part of what the policy outlines, is that every year we have been taking names from people as they've applied. And so it outlines the criteria of we need their discharge forms from the military, and then some information about the individuals so that we can add them to that. One of the things that we're hoping to do as well this year for Memorial Day is to be able to install an additional naming section on that, so that we have a lot of longevity and future-proofing this addition of names, and doing it in a way that is cost-effective as well. One of the challenges we've had in the past is that we had to redo many of the plates whenever we wanted to add names, and it was very cost-prohibitive, so it led to long wait times between additions. So the new change will make it so that we can add them annually, and the hope is that every year we will have those updated by Memorial Day.
All right. Council will also consider a solution to provide increase to tax relief income for seniors. So what's this going to provide them?
So what the state of Utah does is they already have an income tax relief for people that are 66 or older. What Wasatch County is doing is we are increasing the amount that someone can make and still be eligible for these same benefits. Summit County did a similar thing back in 2023, and we actually talked about this in December, and then the council asked us to make some revisions. And so this is what's coming back now before them, is the revisions that they've asked. Basically what it is that right now the state limit is $40,000. We're raising it to roughly $60,000. In an effort to make sure that more people are eligible to qualify. We found that there are many seniors who are on fixed income Social Security benefits and modest pensions that would fall in this income range. And then on a graduated level, they would be able to get some tax relief.
Mm-hmm. So if the state were to adopt a similar income limit, what do you play by? What rules? The state rules or the county rules?
So that was one of the things that we considered, because we've been advocating at the state that we feel like their income limit is too low and should be raised. So what we added is that if the state were to raise the income level in a given year enough, it gets close to our amount, this policy would automatically dissolve because we've succeeded in raising that income limit to a level that we feel like is appropriate.
All right. And then how do seniors have to prove their income to the county to get the tax relief?
So those are things that are set out by the state already in the existing program. I believe that it requires tax forms and kind of statements, affidavits, asserting that they have certain values and certain incomes. The clerk auditor's office in every county administers those programs per the state criteria.
All right. Now, do they still pay an income tax, just less, or does it kind of waive the income tax requirement?
So it doesn't affect their income taxes. What it does is it affects property taxes based on their income. So that if you are under a certain income limit, there is a property tax relief that seniors are eligible for. So in this case, if somebody makes, say $0, they might be eligible for, over $1,000 of tax relief. And I believe that there is a portion of the value of the property that is added onto that as well. So this would enable seniors who are in those low income fixed situations that as their values change or their taxes change, they might be able to qualify for some tax relief.
So Social Security income isn't included then?
I believe that the state of Utah is looking at adopting changes that Social Security income taxes would be eliminated. But the county's income levels, I believe that they have to look at all of the income streams. And so that what this would do is enable someone to collect Social Security taxes and still qualify for this property tax relief.
Okay. Any idea what that means to the county in terms of lost revenue?
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty modest. Summit County only has, I want to say, somewhere around 80 participants. And when you're talking about $80,000 compared to the multiple millions of dollars that are being collected through the tax system, what it ends up doing is it does affect every tax entity, but in such a small way that I think the county council at least feels like it is worth the benefit to these individuals. to affect those kind of in a very minute way.
Okay. Later on, a policy on public comment methodology will be discussed. What's being considered here?
So what really, again, what we're doing is looking at formalizing our existing practices. Wasatch County has code that kind of outlines that the chair runs the meetings, and we have standard practices that we have used. But if you recall last year, Midway City had an incident where they were Zoom bombed, and because of the nature of that, it's always better to be proactive and have a policy in place that clearly outlines the criteria that we use, because we want to be sensitive to people's First Amendment rights, but we also want to make sure that we are able to conduct the public's business in a way that isn't overly disrupted or hijacked by things that are well outside our realm of influence.
So how is this different from what's on the books now?
So right now our county code is just very broad in that it grants the chair authority to administer the meetings and ensure that the business is conducted. What this does is it outlines more specific criteria about the level or discouraging disruption. For instance, having signs that obscure the view of others would be something that would be prohibited under this policy. Now, it doesn't prohibit the use of signs. You just can't use signs to block others' view or things like that, that just make it a little bit more clear. We also have a definition of things like relevant topics, so that if somebody is, like the instance that Midway had, if somebody is ranting about racism or things like that, those are not things that the county has direct purview over and would be able to shut those comments down in a way that allows us to do our business without being disrupted.
All right, and I read that you'll also be limiting comments to just 2 minutes. Why only 2 minutes?
We have actually done that in the past for other public hearings, and what, again, we're trying to do is look at standardizing. Now, it does grant the chair the ability to extend those, but we are just kind of setting the floor of, we feel like it should be at least 2 minutes, and that if we have time, the chair can say at the beginning of a public hearing, we want to allow 3 minutes for this amount of time. I think overall, we have done 2 minutes and even a minute and a half at some of our recent public hearings for other items. And I think everyone feels like it's a sufficient amount of time to get your point across without being too disruptive. And again, the whole point is that we are doing these meetings in the public. The public is invited to participate. But ultimately, we need to be able to do our jobs, and that allows the council to be able to talk about these items and vote on them in a way that isn't overly disruptive.
Okay, and there's also been a limit of 15 minutes on any public comment period, unless the chair would extend that time, huh?
Yeah, so this is something a lot of agencies do, that during the first part of a meeting, you have an open public comment. So this is something that is not required by state code, but is typically done in Wasatch County, where anybody can come up and raise issues that are relevant to the county. And so, again, we kind of are setting the floor of, hey, we want to dedicate at least 15 minutes of our meeting to this portion to make sure that the public has the chance to be heard. I think that the idea is that if there was a hot button issue that wasn't on the agenda, that were many people that wanted to discuss, the chair could say, hey, we wanted to devote an additional 15 minutes. Maybe we want to do 30 or 45 or whatever it is. Again, it just really formalizes things, and it gives us an ability to say how we want to run our meetings and make sure that we aren't spending too much time on things that ultimately, like the open public comment portion of our meeting, are not things that we can act on. Really, the public hearings that we have for other items are not time limited, and those are things that we are required to get public input on. We desperately want it, and we don't always get it, so we aren't putting any time limits on those specific agenda items.
Okay, and then later on you'll be reporting on the initial steps to update the Wasatch County General Plan. So where do things stand here?
So the council has been interested in this since last year. We had a presentation to the Planning Commission in our January Planning Commission meeting just a couple weeks ago. So what we're looking at the council is kind of gauging their desire for a level of public engagement. When Wasatch County did its general plan back in the early 2000s, we created a large committee and had a very collaborative process. And so now that we're, more than 20 years later, we're looking at some other ways that we might be able to reach out to the community members. So we're hoping to get the council's input on that. And the other item is around staffing resourcing. So make sure we know how much time the council wants us to dedicate our staff to, knowing that that has an impact on some kind of more short-term issues that might affect our capacity to respond or make proactive code changes that affect short-term issues. And so we're trying to gauge the council's interest on their prioritization of this long-term project, the general plan redo, versus the short-term needs of some of the policy priorities that they have.
Okay, at 6 o'clock, a public hearing on a code amendment to allow caretaker accessory dwelling units or ADUs within the Jordan L Basin overlay zone. Are they currently allowed in the rest of the county, just not here?
I believe so, that this is kind of a standard thing that if you have a sufficiently sized lot, that we allow caretaker dwellings on some of those. And so this would make it more consistent with some of the other portions of the county.
All right. So how big can these ADUs be?
You know, I don't know that off the top of my head. I have to ask the planning staff, and they will have a pretty thorough presentation there. But in general, they can be, basically the size of a small residence. Often these will be things that, an aging farmer might have someone or a family member or something live on their property and help them take care of it. Especially if it's a large property, there is typically a need for that type of maintenance or ongoing care for the land.
All right. So any concerns you're aware of in allowing these?
We've had them for a long time, and I think that they have been generally used well. And because they're on such large lots, I think there's not a whole lot of concern that this represents a significant change in land use or densities or other things like that.
Okay. Let's see. And looking at some other issues, the council heard a request from Black Rock Resort to consider a CRA, a Community Redevelopment Agency. County Council said they're not interested, but they at the same time allow it for all of the Extel property as well as Sky Ridge. Why not Black Rock? It too is a resort.
I think the concern is that the extent to which we want to mirror the same types of things that are happening in a specific area. I think right now there is a lot going on within the MIDA project area, and I think it's demonstrated that it's already working, that the investment that the county and all the other public entities are making into those infrastructure improvements is resulting in things coming up out of the ground. In this case, the Black Rock Resort already exists, and I think the council feels like it's maybe not the highest and best use of those funds at this time.
All right, what's the latest with the Lundin property? It sounds like this conservation easement may not happen, or what do you know?
Yeah, I think there have been some challenges. The Midway mayor presented last week at our interlocal meeting and talked about how they are still actively working with the Lundins. I think everyone involved, from the Lundins, the county, and Midway, all want to see it happen. I think that there are some unique challenges with this particular property and the property owners involved there. And I think that everybody wants the same thing. It's just some technical issues that need to be worked with. I think right now it's a little bit on pause in that the property owners are working through some issues that they have, and I hope that they will be able to come back to the county and Midway City soon to be able to request those funds and get a conservation easement.
So anything the county can do to help?
I think we've continued to express our support and make sure that they are aware that the funds are still available. Ultimately, it's I think an internal issue to those property owners.
Okay. Finally, just wanted to ask the state legislature, of course, meeting for their 45-day session starting today. Anything Wasatch County is watching?
There are a number of things on this live session every year and a number of surprises. I think it's the surprises that we try to watch for the most, because we don't always know what's going to happen. There are one of the bills that we are tracking right now is House Bill 55 that makes some changes to the way county facilities work. And I think that might have some impacts on how Wasatch County operates. I believe it's being run because of the situation in Salt Lake, but it would apply to Wasatch County. So that's something that's on our radar. There are other things related to development issues that we're aware of, but at this point, it's a little early to tell what is ultimately going to come out of the legislative session.
Yeah, both Summit County and Park City hire lobbyists. Does Wasatch County?
We do, yes.
Okay, who's your lobbyist?
We use David Stewart, who has been a great asset to us and already secured really significant funding for some of the infrastructure projects we've done related to the Provo River Trail and others. I think he's been a great connection to some of the legislators that don't represent our area specifically, and has been really helpful in kind of giving us a heads up on issues as they've come up.
Okay. Dustin, anything else you'd like to add?
Not today.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, the Utah State Legislature opens its annual 45-day session today. On the phone with a preview of what we might expect over the next month and a half, I have KUR reporter Sean Higgins, who along with his colleague Sage Miller will be covering the State House. They also produce a weekly podcast during the session, State Street. Good morning, Sean. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so let's just start with KUR's coverage of the legislature. What, you and Sage take turns, or are you both down there at the Capitol every day?
We are at the Capitol almost every day here in Salt Lake City. We're producing stories, I would say, 2 to 3 times a week. Depends on the big newsy things that come out. There's literally too many bills for two bodies to cover every single one. So we kind of have to make some strategic choices as to what rises to the level of news coverage that gets on the radio, but we do our best. We're here right now. Things really start to kick off in about 30 minutes here. There'll be some press conferences with the Democrats on some of their priorities, and then floor time kicks off the start of the legislature at 10 a.m.
Okay. And tell people what they could expect if they tuned into the State Street podcast. I mean, it's something that I believe you produce year-round, just not as frequently when out of the session.
Yeah, we usually try to do 2 to 3 seasons a year, typically one season in the fall during election time, and then one season January, February, March during the legislative session. So this season, we're obviously covering the legislature. Our first episode came out yesterday. We had two of the three Polynesian legislators who were just elected to the legislature with Doug Fifia and Verona Mauga, a Republican and a Democrat here from Salt Lake County, on the show just to discuss their journey to become legislators, from their families emigrating to the United States in the mid 20th century to now them becoming state lawmakers. So it's a great conversation. You can find that at KUER.org/State Street or wherever you get your podcasts. And then throughout the rest of the session, we're really going to be diving deep into some of these key issues that are going to be hotly debated here on Capitol Hill. I'm thinking immigration is a big one. Obviously, that national conversation has spilled into Utah. We're seeing a lot of bills that are related to immigration, things like public safety and crime, a lot of bills aiming to crack down on people who are here without legal status and then commit additional crimes on top of that, maybe lowering the bar for deportation in some cases, depending on the crime. That's certainly going to be an issue. We're going to be looking at things like energy as well. A lot of talk about Utah investing in nuclear infrastructure in the near future. So where that conversation is going, is it possible? Things of that nature. And another big issue that popped up at the end of last year with all the Supreme Court rulings around these ballot initiatives is some legislatures really want to change the way the judicial system works here in Utah. So potentially some changes to the courts, hoping to get some law professors, maybe a judge, an ex-judge or two on the show to discuss what those changes could look like.
Okay. Let's take just a step back. And you had mentioned the kind of the diversity that we're starting to see with the makeup of the legislature. So are we making some inroads there?
I would say political diversity, no. It's still a GOP supermajority. When you look at the makeup of the legislature, it was basically status quo after the 2024 elections. Democrats didn't gain any seats. Republicans didn't lose any seats. So the partisan split in the legislature is definitely same as it always is, essentially. But we have seen some interesting changes in diversity in other ways. I mentioned those three Polynesian lawmakers, Democrats Jake Fitisimanu from West Valley City, Verona Mauga, the Democrat from Taylorsville, and Doug Fifia, the Republican from Harriman. That is three more Pacific Islanders than we had last year. And you can only think of a few other instances where people with Polynesian heritage have served in elected office in Utah. Former Attorney General Sean Reyes has some Filipino and Native Hawaiian roots. There was a legislator in the early 90s named Representative Weepy, who served for a few years. But other than that, you can't really think of too many times when people from the Pacific Islands have served in elected office in Utah. And when you look at the history of people from those cultures, it dates back to the 1800s with Latter-day Saint missionaries going to these islands and then people immigrating to Utah. So it really is encouraging to see people from these communities step up and run for office and become elected.
Okay, so with no change in the numbers, the party numbers in the 2024 election. It basically means we still have a supermajority, which means if Republicans want something done, it will get done?
Essentially, yes. Where the drama really happens is the makeup of the Republican supermajority. I've heard people who have worked in Republican politics in the state of Utah for a long time who say there are really three parties within the Utah Republican Party. There are the moderates, what you'd call the traditional Republicans, and the people on the far right. And trying to get all of those interests aligned, sometimes those interests are very opposed to one another, is the real challenge for people like Speaker Mike Schultz and Senate President Stuart Adams to really whip those votes and get some of these controversial, depending on how you look at it, where you fall on that political spectrum, bills across the finish line.
Interesting. All right. Can you give us a quick overview of this year's governor recommended budget? It sounds like it's a bit tight this year compared to the last few years.
Yeah. So Governor Cox proposed, it's a $30.6 billion budget, which is, like you said, a little bit tighter than in years we've seen in the past. We're hearing, and this isn't not a phenomenon that is only happening in Utah. Municipalities across the state are tightening their budgets. States across the country are tightening their budgets. And really what that is a product of is a lot of this COVID-19 relief money is ending or has ended already. So there is just simply not as much money to go around to fund some of these programs that were spawned during the pandemic to address some needs there. And now these governments need to get a little bit more creative as far as where they're putting their money. The big thing that Governor Cox is really pushing this year is he wants to nix Social Security tax. Talking with the governor, he's really focused on taking care of Utah's older population who are maybe not earning as much money as they did in the past, but still have financial responsibilities. And he sees lowering that Social Security tax as a big way of doing it. But obviously housing is a big point for him as well. Continued investments there. He still has that goal of building 35,000 starter homes by the year 2030. We'll see how that money gets appropriated. But ultimately, when you look at the Utah Constitution, the one required duty of the legislature is to pass the governor's budget and have a balanced budget at the end of every year. So it is boring. It's a lot of numbers, but this is really important. And it is the required work that the legislature has to do every year.
Yeah. What does that mean for education money? I know Utah Education Association is looking for at least a 3% increase on the WPU, but that's on top of the kind of guaranteed inflation funding.
Yeah, so education is really interesting, and you kind of have to break it out between the K through 12 education funding and then the higher ed funding. And we've heard from legislative leaders, GOP leaders here on Capitol Hill, is they really want to cut higher ed's budget by about 10%. What that looks like, we're not really sure yet. There are some fears it would be arts programs, more humanity-based things to focus more energy and resources on STEM programs, it's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics programs here in Utah. But as far as the K through 12 budget, this is a big focus every year by legislators. And I think depending on who you talk to, Republicans think they fund education just fine, and they are committed to funding K through 12 education at an adequate level. When you talk to people like the Utah Education Foundation or other education advocates, they say it's not enough. So that's going to be a big budget fight over the next 45 days here to see what exactly that weighted pupil unit will be. I think it could definitely increase just with the nature of inflation. Utah's economy is doing quite well, but that is one that's yet to be seen.
All right. And as you mentioned, immigration, we should expect to see some legislation happening there. Of course, we've heard from President Trump, who has promised the largest deportation program in American history to start. What have you seen from the Utah legislature, though?
Well, this is a little bit of a two-pronged approach. You have the actions that the governor can take himself, and then the actions the legislature can take. Mm-hmm. As far as Governor Cox's role in this, he, after the election, pledged to support the Trump administration's efforts to deport people who are here without legal status, who are here illegally. And as far as what that looks like, we are not sure yet. At least Governor Cox, him personally, he told me that he's not interested in going after people simply for being in the country illegally, since that is a crime in and of itself. There would be have to be an additional a crime committed on top of that to, at least in his eyes, rise to the level of deportation. As far as the Utah legislature, I mentioned earlier that they're looking at lowering the bar of what crimes need to be committed before a deportation occurs, changing some sentencing guidelines, where there's an interesting part in Utah criminal law where it is 364 versus 365 days. They want to raise a sentence to a full calendar year, which apparently matches with a federal guideline for deportation. So things like that, increasing penalties for things like driving without a license. Apparently that is a big problem in certain parts of Salt Lake County, where I heard some lawmakers say that in some police districts, 50% of traffic incidents are one, at least one driver is operating their vehicle without a license. So things like that. I think as far as what the Trump administration is promising, there's a lot of questions about the logistics and the money associated with that. But you are seeing these little changes and tweaks to law here in Utah that could make that process a little bit easier.
All right. The governor is also pushing for the legislature to help ease the construction of thousands of affordable housing units. What have you seen out there that would make that happen?
Yeah, so the big push that I've heard the governor talk about is really focusing on some of the barriers that are put up through policy here in Utah that prevent things like condominiums to be built. Here in Salt Lake County, if you drive anywhere in Salt Lake County, you see apartment buildings going up everywhere, and you have to wonder, what do you mean we have a housing problem? We're building apartments up the wazoo. But when you look at that, those aren't owner-occupied units. And the one thing that Governor Cox is really pushing is he wants more people, not just in affordable housing, but in a path to home ownership. And he has really talked about seeing condominiums as part of that solution. So there's already been some proposed legislation to reclassify some things. I've heard it's a big insurance issue for developers when it comes to apartments versus condominiums. Obviously, it's a lot more complicated to have 100 owners versus just one owner that's renting out the whole building. So expect some little changes as far as those things are concerned, classification of certain zones, obviously trying to make condominiums more accessible and more buildable in urban places here in Utah, but expect things like that.
Okay, I need to wrap this up, but I did want to ask you, I don't know if you were part of the Better Utah Institute legislative webinar that they held last week, but a couple of people talked about the crazy list that they keep for the state legislature. Does KUER keep a crazy list?
I wouldn't say we keep a crazy list. We have a big document of bill tracking, and we definitely highlight things that we really need to keep an eye on, things we should probably keep an eye on, and things that aren't that big of a deal for us to follow. So I wouldn't say we call it a crazy list, but we definitely have I would call it a stoplight, maybe, list, where we have green, yellow, and red.
Okay. Well, and I got to just point this out because somebody had mentioned a bill that was going to be introduced basically about gun training and starting that in kindergarten. So she had put that on her crazy list. But
I have heard about that as well, maybe adding firearms training to school curriculum. So we'll see where that one goes.
Okay. Sean, hey, appreciate your time and look forward to our weekly conversations. You and Sage.
Thank you, Leslie.
All right.
Take care.
That's KUER reporter Sean Higgins. As we reported, Recycle Utah Executive Director Carolyn Warr has stepped down from that role, and for now, the nonprofit will be managed by board member Jim Bedell. Both of them, as well as Carolyn's husband, Chris Neville, join me in the studio now to talk about Carolyn's transition. Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Maybe, Carolyn, you start, because I know you have a statement that you wanted to read.
I have stepped down as director at Recycle Utah. I'll be taking on a different role that would allow you to focus on my recovery. I'm grateful for the support I receive from the board, the employee, and community over the years. I'll see you at the center.
Okay. Chris, I'm sure this wasn't an easy decision. Maybe you can talk a little bit about just that.
Right, yeah. Since the stroke happened last May, Cinco de Mayo 2024, obviously we had hoped that Carolyn's recovery from that stroke would be swift and complete, but that hasn't been the case. Obviously, she's made a ton of improvements, and she still continues to improve. But we really have just decided that she needs to focus on getting that recovery when she can get it. We've been incredibly grateful to Recycle Utah for being flexible through this time and continuing to support her and to show her support. They've been really great. You know, I've told a lot of people that injuries like this ruin lives, you know, and her life has not been ruined because of the support that she's got from, you know, Recycle Utah, from the employees, from the community. And she's still going to be at Recycle Utah for now. She plans to be there on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So if you want to stop by and give her a hug, that'd be a great time. But she'll still be around. She still loves Recycle Utah, supports the organization. And we just couldn't be more grateful for the support from the community and from the organization.
Yeah. So the role that she takes on will be more of a consulting role, or are you going to be doing just out there helping recyclers?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a moving target and kind of a, you know, she's staying on because there's a lot of institutional knowledge there that she really just needs to impart upon kind of whoever's moving the organization forward. But she'll still play an important role, you know, with helping with donors and keeping those relationships alive and with the businesses that help Recycle Utah operate. So it's kind of a moving target because we're not quite sure how quickly her recovery will continue. But we just know that, you know, health insurance, you basically get a bunch more credit for at-home therapy when January 1st comes around. So we've got several months of a lot of speech therapy and occupational therapy, and that's what we're going to focus on.
Yeah, how much time does she spend with her recovery every week?
Typically, it's about, we found a really great company called the Aphasia Center that does online speech therapy. So she's been doing 5 hours a week, 1 hour a day of that every week. And then, but we also have a local company called Rehab Without Walls that sends occupational and speech and physical therapists to the house. They're the ones that work through insurance, and so it's really nice that they're starting up again. So we're going to be probably, I think, 10 to 12 hours of speech therapy a week, yeah.
Well, and that kind of lowers your stress level, yeah, too, knowing you don't have to be at the center.
Yes.
Great. Jim, maybe talk a little bit about what are the next steps in her, finding her replacement. I know you have stepped in. Is that permanent or just temporary?
That's a good question. The answer is clearly not temporary. I mean, Carolyn and I have been working side by side for years now. And one of the great things about what Carolyn and Chris just described is she's going to continue to be there working side by side with us. So I'll take on a lot of her operational and executive responsibilities. There is no plan to hire another replacement at this point. We'll wait and see how Carolyn evolves and what she wants to do. And I've been close enough involved with her on this that I'm comfortable stepping in.
All right. So are you doing this as a paid position?
Yeah, well, I've been on the staff since this summer, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
When Carolyn first had her stroke and I stepped in, I've resigned from the board, actually. And last week, the board, after accepting Carolyn's resignation as ED, appointed me general manager. So I'll assume most of her executive responsibilities. And we'll continue to work side by side and take advantage of all the knowledge she has and let her be as engaged as she'd like.
Okay, so you're the one that's going to be there 40 hours a week.
Yes.
Okay, 50 hours a week, yeah. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about just Recycle Utah. They have made a couple of public presentations to teach the community more about the strategic study you've done to basically move the center and build a new one?
Yeah, I think it's the real message is a little bit broader than that. You know, last year, as you guys have reported and we've mentioned on the show, we commissioned a study to look much more extensively at waste management, recycling, and waste diversion throughout the community, in fact, throughout the whole Wasatch Back. And it's the results of those studies that we presented to the community earlier this week. And there were some disturbing findings. The most disturbing one, and the one that's become a real call to action for us, is that despite many ambitious and admirable waste diversion and zero waste goals in the community, our execution's quite poor. Our waste diversion rate is 12% in Summit County. which means roughly 88% of the total waste we create as a community goes to the landfill. We only divert 12. The national diversion rate's 32%. And our mountain town peer communities are all at or above that level. So that's become a real call to action for us. We need to change that.
Our mountain communities are above the 32%?
Yes.
Wow.
Some of them, I mean, Aspen's at 40. Boulder, which is not a direct comparison for us, it's a much bigger organization, but something we admire. They're up in the mid-50s.
Yeah, so what do we blame that on? I mean, Recycle Utah has been in business for 30-plus years. Educating people about why we should recycle.
Yeah, I think where we score well is as a community is on things like education and encouraging people to use less product. I mean, the less you use, the less you have to dispose of. And the one of the conclusions of the study is we're generally, as a community, quite good at that, and Recycle Utah plays its role, but other governments and other entities are also involved. Where we fall short is because we don't have the infrastructure necessary to manage materials. You know, if you do create material and you want to keep it out of the landfill, you have to have some place to take it, and you have to be able to collect it efficiently. And that's the primary conclusion from the study, is we just have not invested as a community in that infrastructure. And that's our top priority for this year. We put forth a plan. There's a meeting tomorrow morning with county and city officials to discuss this. So we're optimistic that we'll be able to push this forward.
At the same time, the center always seems so busy. So if it's so busy, it seems like it's more than 12%. Because we've got, of course, the weekly or the biweekly recycling pickup.
Yep, it is busy. The problem is it's not big enough. And there is no other place to bring your waste. So we need a bigger investment and a bigger facility. And that's something that we learned as a result of talking to our peer communities with our consultants, is they all invested in this a decade or so ago. So in many ways, the solution's pretty easy for us. It requires land, it requires a building, it requires machinery, it requires a collection system, but we articulated a pretty clear plan and we'd like to see it implemented this year.
Yeah, and we've been talking about it for almost a decade, right? I mean, yeah. It could have been done and it hasn't. I mean, why the feet dragging?
I don't know if it's feet dragging. In one way, Helena Sedaris, who's our vice chair, made a great statement at the beginning of one of our meetings. It's almost good that we didn't act on this, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. Because even 3 or 4 years ago, when Carolyn and I first started just talking about this, we didn't appreciate just how dire the situation was, and we might have built a smaller facility that might have gotten us to 14 or 15% or 20, but not up to the diversion rate that we need. So in many ways, it's kind of good that we haven't done this until now.
Okay. So give us some optimism here. I mean, do we have a location? I know we've been talking about the Gilmore property.
Yeah, it's kind of not, I think, Recycle Utah's position to say exactly where this should go, because the reality is this needs to be built by government. There is no nonprofit that we found in the country that has built the infrastructure necessary to manage this type of diversion activity. It's a government function. So we have some ideas, and we've clearly been talking with the city and the county about Gilmore and other locations. Hopefully at this meeting tomorrow, we'll have a little bit more clarity about how they think about that and how they'd like to move forward.
Okay, so building, I was going to ask, building a new center, where does the money come from that? You're hoping could we add Wasatch County into it as well, or?
When we commissioned the study, one of the first things that the RRS consultant said is, let's look more broadly at let's not just look at Summit County, let's think about the whole Wasatch back. So the nice thing about building diversion infrastructure, there's some great economies of scale. So if we build something that's sufficient for Summit County, we can probably also handle flows from Wasatch County. I'll defer to local government on whether they want to get the two counties involved in this at this point. I think more likely outcome and more greater probability of success is if we do it ourselves and then at some point look to take divertible waste from Wasatch County and charge them accordingly.
Yeah. Well, I think what I've heard over the years is that Recycle Utah has been setting aside money to buy land and help build a center. So you have a little bit of a war chest?
Right. We have $1 million for a $25 million project. And as I said, this is not a nonprofit function. We're talking about waste management infrastructure here. And all of our peer communities have basically made that investment from the government side. Some of them have good models where the nonprofit has helped operate it, and that could be a good model for us here, especially since we have a lot of experience doing that, as Carolyn can tell you. But it really needs to be a government investment. And it's an investment. It's not, we're not talking about spending money. We're talking about investing in a facility that can prolong the life of our landfill and provide other benefits.
Okay. Well, what we had heard originally, too, was that Recycle Utah needed to get out of that location. You're still there, so I guess it's not an emergency that you
We
you
are
need?
Still there. We have not received an eviction notice yet.
Okay. Do you expect one here soon, or...?
That's really a question for the city. I mean, you guys know more about the Bonanza Park development than we do, but our understanding is eventually that land will be needed for other purposes.
Okay, and realistically, when could we see construction on a new center?
I mean, we've already sketched out several times, plans for what a new facility would look like. As soon as ground can be broken, we're ready to go. I mean, this is a priority. This is very disturbing for us. We need to make this happen.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say on behalf of Carolyn, you know, that leading Recycle Utah has been the major thing of the past 8 years of her life, and she's been so glad to do it and so lucky to do it. And thanks again to the community for all the support they've shown to her and to the organization.
Okay, and continued good luck on the recovery, Carolyn.